You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rapport. Happy New Year. This week, this year, 2020, we are starting with Healthy-ish editor Amanda Shapiro as she talks to Chris Morocco and Andy Baragani about the recipes in our third annual Feel Good Food Plan. In case you missed it, we're cooking through 10 days of delicious weeknightable, that's a word, dinners starting January 2nd, a.k.a. tomorrow. But it's not a diet or a detox. It is instead an all-star lineup of brand new recipes guaranteed to become your new favorites all year long. You can find out more about the plan and access all the recipes at BeHealthyish.com, or you can go to bonappetit.com/feel-good-food-plan. And remember to tag Healthy-ish on Instagram and use hashtag feelgoodfoodplan, no hyphens, so we can see and share all of your beautiful photos. And then after that, Carla Lolly Music chats with Chris and, in her debut podcast, senior food editor Anna Stockwell about gluten-free cooking and baking. All right, here we go.
Okay, so it is January 1st, 2020, the beginning of an entirely new decade, and we have an entirely new Healthy-ish Feel Good Food Plan to talk about today.
So happy to spend the first day of the new year with you guys.
Yeah.
New Year's Day.
How here we go. Hungover are we all right now? I'm probably not even awake right now, honestly.
My kids have been up since 6:30 this morning.
Yeah. Some things don't change in the new decade.
No,
not at all.
All right. Well, let's talk about food, because I don't know about you guys, but like I'm kind of ready for some healthy-ish cooking this time of year. And I think a lot of our listeners are too. So luckily, the Healthy-ish Feel Good Food Plan is back this year. This is our third year running. And before we jump into talking about the recipes, I just want to talk a little bit about how the plan is different this year. And, you know, we went into it, I think, with a slightly different philosophy and ambition than we had in previous years. We really wanted to make these recipes stand out in some way and feel really
like they could exist anytime.
Exactly.
Like each one was kind of a standalone, right? And in the past 2 years, we've kind of created these week long kind of, you know, almost like menus, you know, like or plans, you know, like broken down week by week. And this year, we just kind of wanted to get away from that a little bit, right? We wanted each recipe to really stand on its own as something that you'd want to make all year long.
A little more evergreen and things that just like techniques and ingredients that you could just kind of integrate in your kitchen very easily.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things we do in recipes for Healthy-ish that we don't really explicitly talk about, like certain techniques and certain ingredients and how we use them. And we wanted kind of people to learn something from the recipes this year and really take away a technique that they can apply into their cooking all year long.
Mm-hmm. We get really excited about these recipes.
I mean, I think this is, for Healthy-ish, this is by far the thing that I get the most excited for every year.
Yeah, we start talking about it in like July and August.
Yeah. And it feels like the culmination of like a lot of where our thoughts are, you know, a lot of things like we've been thinking about through the year. We kind of hold on to things that we want to, you know, kind of work into each year's Feel Good Food Plan for sure.
And I think with each year, we kind of get feedback from, you know, our readers, home cooks, the staff, and we kind of keep wanting to evolve and refine. And I think, honestly, I think this year is the best one yet.
Yeah, and I think for listeners out there and people who are excited to cook through them, you can definitely make these recipes as part of the plan. It's a 10-day plan. We split it into 2 weeks of shopping lists, so you can do your first 5 recipe shopping, your second 5 recipe shopping, do it all the way through. Or, you know, these recipes, like we said, they're really made to stand alone. So cook them in whatever order you want, or cook them over the course of as much time as you want. This is really, it's made to be really flexible. Yeah, let's dive into some of the recipes, because I think we had a really cool recipe development process this year. We weren't so tied to making sure we were reusing every single ingredient and fitting it into these shopping lists as much as we have in the past. So that really let you guys like dream pretty big, which was both a blessing and a curse. So I want to start with the actually the first recipe, which we will be cooking together starting tomorrow because the plant starts officially on the 2nd. And the kickoff recipe are cauliflower tacos with a cashew crema that Andy developed.
You know, this recipe, I think I was very convinced from the get-go, but I think not everybody on staff was convinced right away.
I was like, Amanda, I'm going to be hungry.
Yeah. I think I am kind of maybe a little notorious, especially from the last 2 years with... I love all the recipes that I've developed for Feel Good Food Plan, but sometimes they're a little bit on, let's say,
they're
the
a little
lean
austere.
Side.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Andy has this reputation.
But then... You know, you might get a little hungry at 2 in the
you
morning, but
like
you should be in bed anyway.
You might be reaching for the popcorn, the leftover cookies at like 10 p.m.
But with this, I knew that just having there, I knew it, I wanted it to be vegetarian. I wanted to be kind of slicked with fat, and I wanted to feel nourished. And that's why, like, I did have some, like, some, I don't want to say filler, but I had a really great cashew sauce go along with it. The tacos itself, it's inspired by what I had at, oh my God, I'm blanking on the restaurant, Chris.
Where?
Atla?
Atla, yes, 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 yes. So they had a version, they do Brussels sprouts tacos, they do a cauliflower taco, and there's a lot going on over there. In this case, I kind of want a more streamlined version so that people could actually make at home. And the first thing you do is really make a sauce that's just made out of any kind of nut butter you like. I prefer cashew, but almond butter or peanut butter would be great. And then it's kind of, it gets a little bit of a spice with some green chili or red chili, garlic, plenty of lime juice, and water to thin it out. And that's the sauce for the tacos.
And this sauce is such an amazing shortcut. Like the idea of just starting with a nut butter base, like you're not soaking nuts, you're not blending nuts, you're just using whatever nut butter you have on hand that you want to use. Cashew, what did you say the other one? You could use almonds.
Cashew, peanut, almonds, I think those three would work really well. And it's something that, yes, like I'm using it for the tacos, but it very much can be like an all-purpose sauce. You could thin it out and it could be a salad dressing, really whatever.
You really need that richness to kind of like balance out, you know, having like a vegetable star in your taco.
Yes.
Like you just need a little bit of that fat and something to grab onto.
And what are we doing with the cauliflower?
With the cauliflower, I knew I wanted to do like a hard roast. I didn't want them to be just like tender. I wanted to kind of like shrink up, get crispy, like very, very dark. The cauliflowers are kind of cut into 1.5-2-inch piece florets, which seem big, but they're going to really shrink up in the oven. And they get tossed with a mixture of olive oil, grated garlic, cumin, and smoked paprika. And the paprika kind of stains the cauliflower this wonderful kind of brick red hue, and it gives this kind of almost smoky, meaty quality to the cauliflower. And then from there, you just give it a roast in the oven at 450 degrees, which definitely high heat.
Yeah. And talk for a second about cauliflower or like roasting vegetables in general, because I think people like have a hard time sometimes getting that really hard roast and getting like not just a pile of kind of mushy steamed vegetables. Like what are the tips that people need to know here?
I think you want to space them out so they're not on top of one another and they don't just steam. I pretty much rarely ever line my baking sheet with foil when I'm roasting them. And then again, high heat, and I'll give them a toss maybe halfway.
And you really want them to shrink up and get really dark.
And then from there, you really just assemble. You have some, I like corn tortillas, so I go with those. And then I just spoon some of the spicy cashew sauce. The cauliflower, and then kind of whatever topping you like. A little bit more fat in the form of avocado, some onions, radishes for some crunch, a little bit of cilantro, maybe some mint leaves, and some lime juice.
Yeah, and the sauce and the seasoning on the cauliflower, I think you could make this into a taco bowl. Like you could kind of use these components really flexibly if you, if you're not into the taco idea or if you want to use them.
100%. If you don't want to use tortillas, you could serve it with rice, you could serve it with beans, and it would be a really nice bowl, whether it's for lunch or dinner.
All right, so let's talk about another one. Chris, I want to talk about this kale pesto, which is a pesto, but it's almost it's almost not a pesto. It's something, it's kind of something new.
It's very, I mean, it's very saucy pesto. And so, yeah, we were inspired by Josh McFadden, the chef at Ava Jean's in Portland.
His cookbook, Six Seasons, is a favorite of ours.
Yeah, his cookbook, Six Seasons, is just fantastic, with like tons of ideas of like wonderful things to do with vegetables. And my feeling was, you know, like you can kind of never have too much green pasta in your brand, you know?
Agreed.
Everybody's got like one, if not two, green pastas, you know, behind them, whether it's pesto outright or kind of like a riff on a pesto-ish kind of thing. But the fact is, in the middle of winter, you know, the idea of turning to a soft herb like basil or, you know, kind of parsley even feels a little bit beside the point. Whereas kale is bountiful and it, you know, creates a pesto that is just so vibrantly green. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there is literally no more delicious way to eat a massive big bunch of farmer's market lacinato kale than to, you know, briefly blanch it in, you know, your boiling salted water that's destined for your pasta.
Okay, and then this is like the thing about this recipe that is new for me is you're cooking these greens in advance of making the pesto. Why are we doing that?
So straight up raw kale, it's just, it's so squeaky raw. It's so vegetal. It's like you can almost feel it doing weird things to the enamel of your teeth the way like Swiss chard does sometimes, you know, or like spinach in certain cases, you know. But you give it a very fast blanch. I mean, literally it's a 10 second dip even in your pasta water before you cook your pasta. And it just softens the kale just enough. It sets the chlorophyll in the leaves so you get something very bright green. It cooks it just enough so that it still feels like a raw, you know, kind of pesto. It doesn't feel like a cooked sauce, but the kale has been tempered. It has been slightly subdued, you know, and it's just pure raw vegetable state, you know. It's been turned into something that feels like, okay, this has become like luxurious and soft and a little bit supple, and it frankly wants to puree a lot more easily.
Right. And is that adding to sort of the saucier quality of the of the pesto that we're ending up with?
For sure. For sure. So it means that your pesto becomes like a very, you know, kind of soft textured sauce. We're putting, you know, we're pureeing the kale with olive oil and pistachio, I might add. So, you know, pistachio, it's like a very lovely, you know, kind of relatively subtly flavored nut, you know, in the quantities that we're using it. And it's soft enough so that it purees very easily. So, yeah, not least of all, it's green as well. So that makes a certain kind of sense.
Could I use another nut if I wasn't a fan of pistachios?
You could. It's probably going to leave you with a little bit more texture. Mm-hmm. You know, almond or walnut would probably leave you with a little bit more kind of texture in your sauce. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, with pistachios and the kale, you're getting almost like, it's like a green juice on your pasta. And it doesn't sound delicious, but it really is a great texture to have. It just makes it feel almost like more luxurious than if it were like kind of tighter, drier.
It's like actual like a basil pesto in summer. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I mean, I can barely pick enough basil leaves make enough pesto to have this degree of sauciness to it. You know what I mean? Whereas this is just like, I mean, the kale's just there for the kale. Like, I mean, my God, you know, they're like selling it by the truck full, you know, it's like all that we have in the Northeast, like that and like rutabagas until like May.
You know? Can only eat so many kale salads.
Yeah. Always need that. So, you know, sure, we're putting Parmesan in it. We're putting olive oil in it, but pistachios, you know, replace some of the fat that you otherwise would probably need to add to it. So we're able to kind of keep that a little bit in check, give you a little bit of richness, a little bit of that toasty kind of aromatic pistachio quality.
Yeah, it's a quarter cup of olive oil and an ounce of Parmesan, which is pretty responsible.
Yeah, fairly responsible indeed.
And we really liked this with farro pasta, whole wheat pasta, that sort of nuttier, fuller kind of flavor pasta options.
Yeah, you really, when you're using a whole wheat pasta, you need to have a sauce that has enough flavor to balance it out. you know, if you're just putting whole wheat pasta with just like a regular kind of like pomodoro sauce, I find just like that whole wheat, that nut quality is just hanging out like a bad smell, you know? But this sauce, like, it actually has enough flavor to balance it out. And farro pasta is like, it's not like as intensely earthy as some whole wheat pastas can be. It's like pretty restrained.
Yeah, but I would do this with a brown rice pasta, with any kind of gluten-free option. It could even handle like the chickpea pasta, which sometimes can have that like aftertaste.
You're on your own with the chickpea pasta, but I'm with you right through brown rice.
Yeah, that's cool. We can agree to disagree. If there's any sauce that can hold up, I think it might be this. All right, I want to go back to you, Andy, because we had a bit of a journey with this one recipe. This one is coming a bit. Oh, it's actually our second recipe, so you'll get to
cover
it in
star
2 days. Oh, yes. And it sounds simple. It is now. This is our chicken soup of the year, and I have to say, like, we have a chicken soup on Healthy-ish or on BA as a whole. I'm sure at least one every year, and like, I just think the world can never have too much chicken soup.
Agreed.
Everyone always loves them. We always love them. They become our favorites. And, you know, I wasn't expecting to pop one into the Feel Good Food Plan this year. We had that amazing chicken sweet potato one last year that I was like, cannot be topped.
Yep.
And yeah, we ended up with a chicken soup.
I definitely wanted to do another chicken soup. I felt the pressure. And I have done a lot of chicken soups for BA, for Healthy-ish, for the magazine, for BA.com. I wanted to do a soup that kind of was something that I had growing up. It's called Asha Alu. Ash means really soup in Farsi. Alu means plums. The plum that I'm talking about, though, it's a kind of a sweet, tangy, and almost a touch salty dried plum that's added to the soup. Now, it's just
It did not end up in the final recipe
because it's very hard to find. And just a regular plum or apricot, I think, doesn't do the trick. I did try it with this. Chris Morocco loved it.
Just added a little bit of that sweet intrigue to go with that turmeric scented broth.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's just a touch of sweetness.
But Andy took it out.
I did take it out. Instead, it just a lot more streamlined.
And for the record, you took it out. You did not feel pressured to take it out.
No, I took it out on my own.
I never told Andy to take it out.
No, I pretty much just went on my own.
I was like, we could do it. We could sell a soup with dried fruit in it. And then Andy changed his mind.
I kind of still kind of wanted to mimic those flavors of the soup just without the dried fruit. So the way the soup starts out with is cooking a lot of onions. You cook it until it's just golden brown, and then you add some garlic to it, sliced garlic, and then you take it to a point where it's almost charred at the ends, it's a little lacy, and then rather than leaving it in the pot, I scoop it out, and that's what's going to be the topping for the soup.
So you make your topping first.
Exactly. And then you add, boneless, skinless chicken thighs, red lentils that have been rinsed, and you add water, turmeric, and you bring it to a simmer and cook it gently until the lentils are very tender and the chicken is cooked through. And then you remove the chicken, kind of shred it apart however you like. Add it back in with a little bit of parsley and some lemon juice. It needs that acidity.
And I know we talked about this. I was like, Andy, can't we call for a boneless piece of chicken that people aren't going to have to like deal with the skin or take off the bone? And you were adamant that this broth needed the bone-in chicken.
Yes, I think I just said boneless, but it should be bone and skin on chicken. There's not a lot going on. There's just 10 ingredients, including salt and pepper. So you need the fat from the skin and you need the bone to add that richness because we're calling for water rather than stock. I'd say pretty much almost majority of my recipes, I never call for stock. If you have stock, throw it in. If you have a good chicken stock, go right ahead. But I develop with just New York's finest fresh water tap. So you have this super savory turmeric spiked lentil and chicken soup. I kind of bring it back to life with some lemon juice and then just plain yogurt. Not Greek. If you have Greek, just thin it out with some water.
You want a drizzle.
You want it to be definitely a drizzle, just kind of to flow to the top. and I just spoon the yogurt over, and then I top it with that with the lacy onions and garlic that we cooked beforehand.
And the lentils in here are really great. It's not like a lentil soup where you really see them or even really notice, but they add this sort of richness and this body to
exactly.
it that make it seem like it's simmered, like it's a slow simmering kind of stew, even though it comes together in like the 20 minutes, 25 minutes that
exactly.
the lentils take.
There seems like there's a lot going on, but really just happens in like 35 minutes in one pot.
I have to say, we're really leaning into lentils these days, and I'm here for it.
And frizzly onions. Like,
yeah.
2019 was very quietly the year of the frizzly onion,
yes.
I have to say. Like, we put it on our squash bowls that Sola did,
mm-hmm.
and her...
And in that sauce.
And in the korma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great technique. I mean, just massive amounts of flavor. Cool. Alliums give you all that.
Yeah. Okay, so... Let's talk about one more recipe, just in case you're not sold on the plan yet. I think there's one more that I want to talk through, just because I think it deserves a little bit of love and just kind of explanation. So we have our last recipe in the plan is a shrimp noodle salad. And I think we went back and forth on this one a lot. We thought, you know, is this too summery? How do we make this feel like it, you know, belongs as part of the plan? How does it feel? How do we make it feel like new and healthy-ish and not something you would see on like a, you know, your anywhere sort of Thai menu? Like what mm-hmm. what kind of goes into this dish and how did it come together?
Well, yeah, we started out with this idea. I had this vision of a Som Tum salad, you know, like kind of like a green papaya, you know, Thai salad that I wanted to bring in like that kind of bright, punchy, like lime acid fish sauce, you know, because just like it's just great set of flavors to kind of sort of have at your disposal to just bring, you know, to do very little work, but like have like kind of maximum, you know, flavor. And I wanted to try it with lentils and that didn't work. There was just something about the earthiness of the lentils just like was kind of at odds with how bright and punchy the dressing was. So we kind of did a bit of a pivot and, you know, then settled on shrimp because it's one of those things that's like, we don't do that much with shrimp on Healthy-ish.
Really don't.
And I don't know exactly why. I mean, it's just like, it's a readily available protein, you know, and a lot of people love it. I think just for us, like it often just doesn't feel like enough of a solution for people. You know, we want to kind of find a little bit of joy in like the unexpected things. So if we're going to do shrimp, like we want to do it in like a really great way. And what we came up with for this was the idea of having a fish sauce vinaigrette. So, you know, fish sauce, serrano, chili, honey, and olive oil, you know, sort of forming like the backbone of this dressing for the noodle dish and as, you know, that we use as a marinade for the shrimp itself. So the shrimp gets a 10-minute marinade in some of that dressing, gets sauteed, so you get a little bit of kind of blistery, you know, kind of like flavor development from just that touch of honey, just allows you to get like a tiny bit of char on it. And then the rest of it is just sort of tossed together. We used glass noodles because they're incredibly springy and textural.
And tell us about glass noodles. So what do people look for? What are they made from?
So they're made from usually mung bean starch. And they're called glass noodles because when they're cooked, they're almost translucent, like transparent. And they have a very particular firm, kind of like bouncy texture. That is like just for me, like way, way more delicious and intriguing than like rice vermicelli.
Right, where you get like the danger of overcooking and getting mushy.
It gets
That's just
mushy,
such a fine line.
They
yeah.
break apart. The texture starts to disappear the smaller the noodle gets with rice noodles, I find. Whereas these, you know, even the thin ones, they just like cook up like very plump, you know, these like tight little coiled cylinders.
And they're great cold, which is how this dish is served.
So yeah, the cooked glass noodles, you know, just briefly boiled in salted water and drained, get tossed with your remaining fish sauce vinaigrette, and then with crushed peanuts, cucumbers, basil leaves. So it's one of those simple things that came together in the end, like very easily that we felt great about, but it's just a little bit of a winding road to get there.
Yeah, I think when we do use shrimp, we figure it out and it ends up being one of our best recipes. Like I always think about that shrimp and basil stir fry that you did, Andy, for our Farmers Market Challenge 2 years ago and what a staple dish that's become. And actually similar with the honey, a little bit of sweetness, like a really quick stir fry. Like I think that... Yeah, I'm all about a little more shrimp in 2020 too.
Yeah.
All right. So before we wrap up, I want to mention the Feel Good Food Plan is 10 dinner recipes, but of course we always have a dessert and this year is no different. Sarah Jampel, who is the Basically editor and also writes the Not Depressing Vegetarian column on Healthy-ish, developed our dessert recipe this year. It is really a standout. You guys have both tried it, and yep. I think we agree that she really hit it,
she nailed it
out of the park this time. Yeah, so it's a date caramel cup. Just pureed dates with a little bit of salt makes this like just super luscious, rich, completely naturally sweetened caramel between melted chocolate in sort of, she ended up doing them in muffin liners, right?
Yeah, just as a way to kind of keep everything together. So it's like a turtle, you know, kind of like that formula of melted chocolate, pecans or some other nut and caramel. And so she used the date for the caramel, you know, and then she kind of assembled them in muffin tin liners just as a way to keep everything together and keep that caramel contained. So that you can kind of dollop it onto the nuts, pour chocolate over, and everything just sort of like, you know, nothing kind of ends up sticking to you or your counter.
And these are great because they're little, they're bite-sized, you know, you're not like, oh, I'm going to eat the whole pan by mistake. You just kind of grab and go. Great for after dinner.
You don't want to eat the whole pan, though.
You will want to, but at least you can, try to have some restraint. And they keep for a long time, so,
yeah.
You know.
If you can make it that long.
Yeah, a couple weeks in the fridge. All right, great. Well, thanks, everyone. And happy cooking for the next 10 days and beyond.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All right, well, I've just been alerted that we have 20 minutes to cover the entire world of gluten-free baking and cooking.
That's we can do it in 18.
Not enough time.
It's like not enough time to like get a pot heated up with some olive oil and garlic simmering,
yeah.
As it turns out.
It's a little scant.
Well, let's maybe think about this in two ways. There's maybe just dividing the big world of the kitchen into savory and sweet and try to organize around that a little bit. So the two of you have a lot of experience in the gluten-free world, but from kind of different perspectives. Because Anna, you're celiac.
I have celiacs, yeah.
So Anna's like the real deal. She's not just like on a GF diet. And
I was doing it before it was cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know. And I want to talk about that too, because it seems like if there's a time to be gluten-free, it just gets better.
It keeps getting better.
It keeps getting better. And then Chris is married to a gluten-free practitioner.
Yeah, and my sister actually has celiacs. So this kind of came up, you know, when I was in my early 20s. Nobody knew my sister had it until she was in her mid-20s.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, like, the hilarity of like four Italian uncles being like, wait, you mean you can't, wait, but what with the, even if I, and you're, no, Uncle
no,
John,
no,
she can't.
Really, not just even a little bit of flour on the eggplant is not okay.
Yeah.
But you cook gluten-free a lot at home.
Yeah, for the most part.
And so you've both developed GF recipes for Epi and for BA and Healthy-ish. So,
yeah.
And Chris kind of, is very good at being my watchdog in the kitchen.
Oh, and making
sure I don't
eye.
Eat things that have secret gluten in them.
Yeah, that's
well,
a big thing.
That's it a good is. Place to start, actually. Yeah. So secret gluten. So if you're, I feel like at this point in your life, you're pretty attuned to like what will and won't or the times when you need to ask. But what are some of the ingredients that if someone is just starting out on their gluten-free voyage might trip you up?
Soy sauce for sure,
because it contains, in addition
wheat.
To soy, wheat. Yeah, not all soys do though, right?
Right. Tamari does not contain wheat.
Tamari usually does not, but you really need to,
check
each bottle, because now tamari is just kind of thrown around a little bit interchangeably with soy, but you have to really flip the bottle and check.
And then there are some soys that are wheat-free.
Yes.
Like we recently
like the
had
one that Lisa brought me, and I forget the name of it, but it was a beautiful Taiwanese soy sauce that was made just from rice.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so soy, sub tamari, read the label. What are some of the other things?
Gauchujang, oyster sauce, hoisin, any of these sort of like fortified Asian condiments that might have thickeners in them, might have wheat in there, or they might just have soy sauce in there that contains wheat as well.
And sometimes they always have it, and sometimes, like with gochujang, they don't. It's just brand to brand.
Interesting.
It's wild. Yeah.
So, but because wheat is one of the 8 main allergens that have been like deemed by the FDA, they have to be declared on the label. So actually, you should be able to look at the nutrition info, and up at the top it should call out specifically contains wheat, so you're not combing through. Because my next question was going to be, what are some of the ingredients that maybe don't have wheat in the name that are like secret wheat?
For people with celiacs, we also can't eat barley. And malt barley extract is used in a lot of cereals.
Right.
So like Rice Krispie Treats, you might think are gluten-free.
Because they're rice.
Because it's rice, but they one of the flavorings is malt barley.
It's kind of like an alternative sweetener almost.
Yeah.
And not all oats are also gluten-free.
That's
right?
A cross-contamination
issue. That's cross-contamination. Yeah. You can get GF oats.
It just means that they're grown separately and harvested separately.
Wow.
Because oats and wheat are often grown next to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. When Cosmo was still had his sesame allergy, it was frustrating for me because sesame is the 9th. So like the top 8 are like soy, eggs, dairy, wheat, whatever. And sesame is the 9th most common allergen. But it didn't make the cut. Like in whatever backdoor meetings in the Capitol they had, they went with those 8. So sesame is one that doesn't have to be declared in.
Sesame lobby was just too strong that year.
The all caps declaration.
Yeah.
When does the GF challenge come up the most in savory? Obviously things like you mentioned your Italian uncles. So like obviously pasta is a big one. And so I go to a lot of restaurants now that offer gluten-free pasta. It's usually with a $2 surcharge, which seems like a discriminatory practice.
Yeah.
It's like the like pink tax. It's like some other
pasta. Calm
I know.
Down.
Why are you charging extra? But you have a favorite GF pasta, Anna.
I have 2 favorites. I've tried a lot of different brands. I like the Jovial brand gluten-free pasta as like a pasta substitute.
It's incredible. Incredible.
It's an Italian brand,
it's 100%
and they make it
brown
right.
rice. And I don't know what they're doing to their brown rice that everybody else can't seem to figure out. The texture is wonderful. It gets
it
al
really
dente
mimics,
and it stays al
pasta.
Dente.
Mm-hmm.
The casa recchi, the penne.
Casa recchi is my favorite.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Delightful.
Shout out to Jovial.
Jovial,
Big
we
shout
love
out to
you.
Jovial. When I found it meant that I no longer cooked 2 kinds of pasta at home.
Wow.
It was so good that
it was good enough
all
for
of
you?
A sudden, oh, it's absolutely good enough for me. That's why I'm cooing and ooing and awing over here.
I remember trying some gluten-free pastas a few years back. And one of the things that I remember from the taste test, which was like one of those blind taste tests that we did, was that it was much more successful in the short, the cut shapes than in the long. Is that still true?
Yeah, because you don't have the gluten holding it together.
Right.
Yep.
So
it falls
in
apart.
A strand, it has a tendency to break. Okay, mm-hmm. So Jovial brown rice and what else?
Jovial also makes a tagliatelle, though, that has eggs in it.
Oh.
And that holds together better in the long strand because the eggs take over some of the binding power that gluten would usually have.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So when you're cooking, you throw a lot of dinner parties, Anna. Do you ever cook pasta? Is that ever? I know it's hard to do for like
pasta
a group
for
of 8.
More than 4 people is just a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not, you're not serving
I'll
to
cook
friends.
Pasta for 2 or 3, and they just eat the gluten-free pasta that I'm eating.
Good.
They don't mind.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, they're getting a free dinner and hospitality.
Exactly.
If someone's complaining, they're on dish duty.
One of my Italian friends, though, once hosted me for dinner, and she cooked 2 separate pots of pasta.
Wow.
And then she tasted mine, and I had brought the Jovial.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, wait, this is actually good. I didn't have to have cooked 2 pots.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Double Italian endorsement. And you had a second brand.
Oh, I also love bonza. I make bonza for myself for dinner quite often. It is made out of chickpea flour, so it does not mimic normal pasta.
Right.
It's its own
Chris
beast.
Made a
Chris
crazy
does
face
not like
when
it.
We brought up
Sorry.
Bonza.
Yeah.
But for like a quick and easy gluten-free dinner, and it's full of protein and fiber.
Yeah, a lot of people do this, even for kids, you know, people will make
it's more
know,
filling
the
than
red
pasta.
Lentil pasta, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. And, you know, we maybe I found put a good sauce on it. Okay. But I don't know. Sometimes it's just like, I don't want to taste the pasta that intensely.
Got it. So, and is it also softer in texture than
it's like a little chewier. Yeah.
A little chewier.
And thicker.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But not mushy.
The smell that comes off that water, though, it's like that dark side of like bean water, mm-hmm. you know, where it's just a little funky, you know.
Yeah, you do have an exquisite nose.
Chickpeas are
nose,
funky,
though.
Too.
Yeah, they are. It's true. Yeah. Stick your nose in a can of chickpeas, which I did earlier today.
Yep. No, thank you.
Okay, so that's two great recommendations where you wouldn't really have to change anything else except for the brand of pasta that you're using. And then what are the other things when you're reading a recipe, Anna, you find most often you're like, oh, okay, like flagging for substitution?
Well, if it's a stew or a sauce that's thickened with flour.
Right.
That is
so a lot of
problem.
Times, like if you're making a beef stew, you might, like the French way would be to like coat the pieces in flour before browning them. Sometimes it comes in the form of a roux. Sometimes you might do a beurre manier, which is in our gravy this year.
What do you do?
So when, you know, I went to the French Culinary Institute and my old school French teachers were like, it's just a little bit of flour. You'll be fine. Like it dissolves into the stew. You'll be fine, Anna. And I'm like, no, I actually won't be fine.
Yeah.
So they let me do it with cornstarch instead.
Cornstarch, okay. Yeah. And do you use the same amount or do you pull back a little bit?
Pull back a little bit. Yeah, because cornstarch thickens up more.
Do you ever use a 1-to-1 GF baking flour, you know, mix instead of AP in those applications?
In those applications, yes. And you that do. Also, like in culinary school, I always carried a bag with me of cup for cup.
Oh
okay.
God, love it. Because, in your toolkit.
Yeah.
You like have like the secret baggie.
Yeah.
So it'll build a roux similarly?
Sort of.
Maybe
it's not
quite.
It's not quite as intense, but it will.
That's cool.
Do a little bit of what it's supposed to do.
Occasionally I'll use like in small quantities, like if I'm making just like macaroni and cheese, but with like a very bare minimum of binding, I'll use like the Bob's Red Mill 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm. That didn't exist yet when I was in school.
Right, I know. Right. I mean, that's
cup
the thing.
Cup for Cup was the first one.
Right. A lot of these products are fairly recent, and Cup for Cup was definitely, you know, big early entry in that space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I use Bob's, you know, because I tend to be able to just find it a little bit more readily.
Right. Yeah, Cup for Cup I used to have to go to William Sonoma
for. Oh, I know. They were the only people who sold it.
I remember when
so
it came
so expensive.
Out. Very. Yeah. Okay, so thickening as a thickening agent. And then, Chris, when you're doing like a cutlet or something like eggplant parm that you might dredge in flour before doing the egg and not breadcrumb.
Yeah.
Like, how do you make a good GF, like chicken cutlet?
You know, okay. So
one of life's great pleasures.
I make chicken cutlets for the kids all the time because it's just, you know, one big chicken nugget. So, of course, they love it.
Right.
And so I'll either use cornstarch or I'll use gluten-free 1-to-1 flour on the chicken itself.
Because the function of the flour in that step when you're doing the 3-step dredge is really just to get the egg to adhere.
Yes.
So as long as the egg has something to hold on to.
Exactly.
It's fine.
You just need something very fine.
Right.
Right? So that the egg can kind of adhere. And then Kikkoman, I believe it's Kikkoman, makes a gluten-free panko that's not amazing, but it's serviceable. It's a very strange substance.
Mm.
It's like 100% like, I don't know, some starch of some vegetable or something, and like water, and like that's it. It's not bread.
Right.
I think breadcrumbs are where
a rice, like a puffed rice that didn't have the barley malt.
I mean,
you could.
Sometimes I'll use like a little almond flour.
Mm.
It's a little shaggier, you know. It's a little kind of clumpy, but it works, and like the flavor's really nice. So I'll do that a little bit.
Rather than an almond flour, I like to do like finely chopped nuts.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So it has a little bit more texture.
Okay,
yeah.
So we're talking about now after putting on the flour for
flour
the dredge,
or cornstarch
then you've got
dredge,
your eggs,
then
and you're
egg.
Using a gluten-free flour or cornstarch or not almond flour. Almond flour is for the finish. So then going egg and then dipping into a nut flour or finely chopped nuts or barley-free rice.
Or cornmeal.
Oh, cornmeal.
Coarse cornmeal.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It stays super crunchy.
It has a harder crunch to
it. Yeah.
But I kind of like it.
Right. We also recently came across the sweet potato flour. Mm-hmm. Also, Anna was working on a great story that's going to come out in the December-January issue for Lunar New Year. Yep. We got turned onto the sweet potato flour.
It was so good.
And it got really, really crunchy. Without being like starchy or kind of brittle.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good ingredient. Have you brought that home yet?
We used it all. I have to get more.
And then I remember, Anna, when we were working on Thanksgiving, I remember asking you very naively and kind of with some ignorance behind it too, like, how do you make a gluten-free stuffing? And Anna looked at me and she was like, you use gluten-free bread.
Yeah, Carla.
And I was like, right. Because that's the thing too, and there are a lot of package, like we've been getting into the Ezekiel. Those are GF, right?
No,
never mind.
No. Those are, yeah, they're like sprouted.
They're sprouted. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Better for you, but not.
Do you have a favorite? Do you guys have favorite GF breads that you keep at home? Packaged?
So, I've recently discovered this bread on Fresh Direct, and it's from this place upstate called the Gluten Free Bakery.
Yeah. From Chatham, New York.
Yeah.
That's ours too. Wish we could have just talked about this years ago rather than having like crappy gluten-free bread
it's
for like years.
It's so good. They're brioche buns. Hamburger buns. Have you had those?
I don't know if we've had those.
Oh, got to get those. They're labeled gluten-free hamburger buns, but basically they're just these huge, delicious brioche buns. And something about how much egg is in there. Mm-hmm. Again, like we were talking about earlier, using eggs in gluten-free products like helps replace the gluten. Yeah. That gluten-free brioche is so good.
Wow.
Gluten-free bread is tricky because sometimes what they come across to me is it's not that they're bad so much as just nutritionally void. It's like too much white rice flour, and not enough of anything else.
But then I feel like on the opposite end of the spectrum, you're getting the like miracle loaf thing.
Oh,
where
yeah,
it's just
sure.
like
life-changing loaf.
Life-changing loaf, which is like, you know, great if you love psyllium husk and you're like cool with like dealing with the repercussions of eating that for the next 3 days. But they're like, it's just, you know... Yeah, seeds being held together with the jelly that forms when you soak psyllium. Like, that's not something I'm going to put a burger on.
No, not at all.
I do like that bread. I like it. I like a tiny little slice of it for breakfast, toasted. But yeah, you have to have that in small doses.
Right. Or like you're saying, there are a lot of gluten-free products out there that are highly processed and like not super great for you.
Right. And I find, you know, at least something that has, you know, a little bit of maybe it's sorghum flour, brown rice flour, millet. You know, there's just other ways to build in kind of texture and a little bit of flavor intrigue, if you will.
Yeah, Udi's makes a millet bread.
Yeah.
And Udi's is usually available at all grocery stores. Like even like the random little ones in my neighborhood. But their millet bread is nice because it has whole grains of millet in it.
Cool. Mm. All right, so pathway to talking about flour and getting into baking, because this is such a big... And
we need a whole separate hour for baking.
But two of my favorite recipes that you guys have developed both happen to be gluten-free. Mm-hmm. One is Anna's heartbeat cake that was on Healthy-ish came out last February, and then Chris's gluten-free carrot cake, which I said at the time I would just make even if there were plenty of gluten tolerant people around. How do you guys approach a gluten-free baking challenge? Let's start with you, Chris. Is it about finding just the cup for cup or flour replacement, or how do you go about it?
Yeah, you know, in the past we've tended to feel that offering somebody a recipe that's kind of just saying, okay, make this cake, but just instead of all-purpose flour, put in this one-to-one gluten-free baking mix instead, feels a little bit like a cop-out. Like, you know, if you want to take it upon yourself, like last night I was making chocolate chip cookies and I knew it'd be a hit if I kind of made them gluten-free. So I used Bob's Red Mill one-to-one with BA's Best chocolate chip cookies. I upped the flour by about 5% and it worked. The texture wasn't the same though. You know, it was fine, but I think what we've leaned on a little bit more heavily is, you know, developing recipes that are purpose-built to be gluten-free and avoid, you know, having to make that kind of substitution from the get-go.
Right.
And we do that, you know, in a few ways, but the, you know, what I've found with cakes, and Anna kind of pointed me towards this like amazing Alice Medrick oat flour sponge cake that I did for my wife's yearly trifle birthday sort of trifle. Surprise thing.
Yes.
Because it's hard to get like a sponge that's like really nice and light, you know, but like also gluten-free because you need that extensibility, you know, usually for, you know, in wheat flour to be able to get that kind of lightness. But, you know, with the gluten-free carrot cake, you know, what we found was a similar thing of just beating eggs and sugar to the ribbon stage. So in other words, incorporating a ton of air into them, like confers already off the bat a huge amount of structure to a cake such that you can take an almond flour, as was the case with gluten-free carrot cake, and the cake will hold together.
Got it.
Yeah.
Because the egg is providing both structure and that elasticity and helping with rise.
Yes, exactly. So you're getting structure, you're getting binding, you're getting air. It's all happening.
Okay. So, and so, because really anybody at home could kind of take the promise that's on one of these packages of like substitute, you know, a cup for a cup of any of these like GF baking mixes that exist. And kind of if you're a gluten-free baker person, you're going to like mess around with it and you can kind of approach any recipe that already exists. But you're saying, we know it's going to be gluten-free. We know that the gluten-free substitution is going to come with its own kind of texture suitcase.
Yes.
And like, what else can we do to kind of work with that to optimize it?
Right.
Well, that
right.
was very kind because that cake is
so good.
And
so
like,
good.
I love carrot cake. It's one of the two options of birthday cake that are available to you if you are in my family.
What's the other option?
Marble cake with fudge frosting that somehow, I don't know, both of my kids and my sister's kid had the carrot cake for their first birthday, and then they become marble cake converts. And my husband was always a carrot cake person. And then at a certain, I think it was just peer pressure, at a certain point he was just like, you know what? People love the marble. And then we made carrot cake for Gia for her first birthday like a couple weeks ago. And now Fernando's back on carrot cake. So April, I'm going to be like, maybe he'll know it's GF and maybe he won't. And then Anna, what do you turn to when you're thinking GF baking?
Yeah, I mean, I think rather than, like Chris was saying, rather than trying to replicate something but make it gluten-free, I like to use the ingredients that I can eat and feature their unique flavors. And I really love the book by Alice Medrick called Flavor Flowers, which is what that oat cake that Chris was talking about is from, because that's what she does in that book. And she's an amazing baker, and I trust her recipes.
She's a legend.
And she has chapters divided by different types of flours, and she's developed recipes in there that really feature the flavor, hence the title, of those flours. And she was the one who got me really hooked on oat flour. Like, I love oat flour now. It has such a delicious, nutty, oaty flavor, and it has a really nice, fine, light texture to it. Mm-hmm. It's very good for cakes.
And do you buy oat flour? Or do you buy gluten-free oats? And
I buy
and
oat flour
them?
From Bob's Red Mill.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's a thing that it's people a thing. Can get.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I love doing cakes that are naturally gluten-free.
Like, okay.
As often as possible, I try to develop recipes that don't require like crazy flours.
Right.
So that anybody can make them. Like a flourless chocolate cake is naturally gluten-free, but it's still a cake. Or like my beet cake used a lot of, well, beet puree, but then also a lot of cocoa powder in place of flour.
Right.
So there's ways to get around baking without having to use flour substitutes.
So then something like a pie crust or a pastry crust that is really built on AP flour.
Yeah. I just skip it.
You skip it.
Yeah, I love a crumb crust.
It's hard.
It's hard to make a flaky pie crust gluten-free.
Right.
You can make like a cookie-like crust for a shortbread, you know, kind of like a shortbread style crust for a tart. That can be really good. But yeah, if I'm making pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, I'm pulsing up ginger snaps and pressing them into a crumb crust.
Gluten-free ginger snaps.
My and go Del with, brand.
So rather than fighting what's going to be a very difficult road, just where you're trying to
choose
make
a different road.
Right.
I feel like there are rewards at the end of those roads. You know, like Erin, when she came in and did her gluten-free sourdough, you know, she was using like a whole mix of flours and stuff. And it was Erin of Canelle Vanille.
Right.
You know,
her bread is amazing.
Her bread is amazing. Right. And she's gone deep into it. And if you're willing to do
very
that,
very complicated.
You know, then by all means, like go ahead.
Her new book is out now. Yeah. Yes. So it's that, and it's beautiful.
It's beautiful, and she's awesome, and her
and
recipes,
those recipes
are,
work.
Are,
yeah.
Yeah, they work, and they're great. But yeah, it's tricky. You know, it's definitely not for everybody.
So a pressing crust is going to be like more working in your favor, or
especially if you're like hosting Thanksgiving and one of your guests is gluten free and you've never baked gluten free before.
Right.
Like, just go with a pressing crust. Make it easy.
And buy a GF cookie.
Yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Last words of advice for people stepping in.
Read the labels.
I think people have never like been in a better position to like honestly like be able to eat GF, but eat really well. So I mean, you've come along at the right time, I'd say.
Yes, I eat so much better now than I did when I was diagnosed.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I guess as a hostess myself, who is a complete ingenue about this, I would just say make chocolate mousse.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with chocolate mousse.
I love chocolate mousse.
Wait, but powdered sugar. Isn't powdered sugar one of the ones that sometimes has flour? Do you have to be careful?
I didn't think so. I thought just only ever cornstarch.
It's cornstarch. Okay, yeah, myth busted. Cool. Don't worry about powdered sugar.
I think it's baking powder.
Baking powder can sometimes contain gluten.
Because they often will carefully label it gluten-free baking powder. And recipes that are gluten-free will say, like, make sure you use gluten-free baking powder.
Interesting.
Wow, I didn't know that was a thing.
I love it when they started putting gluten-free on all the bags of potato chips.
Ugh. Oh, and
it's like gluten-free potato chips, like, you don't say.
And gluten-free milk.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. All right, guys, don't forget the gluten-free milk.
Thanks, Carla.
Bye.
Thanks.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.